Okay, welcome. Sorry we're getting started late. Welcome to session 373, Life is a Highway, Mormon Women's Spirituality in the 21st Century, or something like unto that. My name is Doe Daughtry. I'm a PhD student and instructor at Arizona State University. And my specialty is new religions in America, new and alternative religion in America, including Mormonism. And my doctoral dissertation project is going to be to look at popular spiritual practices amongst women primarily, although I'm interested in talking to men too, who have Mormon backgrounds. And so I put together this panel because I really just want to know what Mormon women are up to. Not necessarily active women. I mean, I didn't recruit just active women or women who are inactive or have left the church, but women from all the whole spectrum of Mormonism. And so I am really pleased to have Michael here with us, Michael Farnsworth. We're going to start with him. He gave an absolutely brilliant presentation yesterday or the day before?
Yesterday.
I've collapsed my days. on women's roles in the church and women, the things that hold women back in Mormonism. And so we're going to start with Michael. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read each bio and introduce these people and then let them speak. And so Michael has a doctorate of education degree in educational psychology. He recently retired from Ricks College as a marriage and family relations professor in that department there. And he'll tell you what he does, but he has a lot of really good ideas about how LDS women can empower themselves. Next, we're going to hear from Jana Remy. And she is a doctoral candidate, like myself, in American history, though, at the University of California, Irvine. She's also a very important figure in the blogger sphere. And so she is a blogger at Exponent 2, Sunstone Blog, and she is pilgrimgirl.blogspot.com. And she's also on the Sunstone Board of Directors. Next, we will hear from Sharon Kennedy. She grew up in Sacramento, California, and San Diego, California. She's always been a fan of Dan Weatherspoon, who is her brother. She graduated from BYU and served a mission in northern Italy. She taught school several years before getting married. She has 5 children and 1 grandchild. And she lives in Carlsbad, California, and works at a high school. She considers herself 100% active Mormon, but admits to having some unorthodox beliefs. Next, we will hear from Kathy Wilson. And Kathy is married to Ted Wilson. She's a mother of 5 children. You were divorced in 2003. But have been married to Ted Wilson, who is the mayor, right, of Salt Lake City. She is a business owner. She owns Sago Art and Frame, fine art and framing artist. She's been involved in politics for over 30 years, especially as the wife of a politician. And she was also on the board of directors of Sunstone. She's currently a volunteer, so she's been the one in charge of all the artwork out there that you've seen. So she's been working with international groups to advance health, education, women, and peace, and she's interested in the evolution of humanity. So she also was a panel member of the Mormon Transhumanist Association, that panel that spoke yesterday, I believe. And so that would be a really good one if you want to buy one. It's very, very interesting, Mormon Transhumanism. And she is learning, she says, that change creates personal growth and that is good. And then next, we will hear from Elizabeth Quick. She is an MA student in women's spirituality trying to finish up at the New College of California in San Francisco. She also maintains several blogs and websites, including In Memory of Her and Priestess Academy. And one of those is called Bethany Magdalene at space.com, and the other is Priestess Academy blogspot.com. And so I'll turn the time over to Michael.
Thank you. I'm going to suggest to the panel, if you want, to go sit out there, because the most interesting part of this presentation is going to be found in the cartoons that are going to be shown. I've entitled my paper, The Heroine's Journey, Reclaiming the Feminine Ish of Self, as in selfish. Introduction. I believe women in this culture have been forced to make an unknowing compromise between their spiritual selfhood and the culturally determined feminine role play. Unfortunately, women have been made to feel perverse if they attended to their own self. They have been labeled selfish, one of the most emotionally laden cultural insults that can be levied against them. They have been shamed into hiding and pretending that their real self, feelings, and accompanying wants and needs were bad, wrong, or just unimportant. I do not believe that being who we are is a bad thing. In fact, I believe it is the first pivotal step on the road to salvation, because as long as we remain unauthentic, even God can't do anything with us. The true self is the only essence Christ can change and redeem. That is why pretense and hypocrisy are so harmful, even if used for grand and noble purposes. They remain a counterfeit and a sham. The spiritual adventure of reclaiming the true self requires a surrendering of the secular, idealized, dishonest ego, which we have spent a lifetime constructing. We must be willing to relinquish the stranglehold on our culturally contrived outer life while meekly submitting to the spiritual pilgrimage of reclaiming the inner kingdom of the soul. It may well be the most difficult thing we ever attempt. This paper will explore a difficult paradigm shift of reorienting the feminine self from the cultural objectification of the world to the intimate compassion of the heart. However, it is impossible to embrace the feminine self, which either sponsors deep-rooted feelings of self-contempt or which remains asleep. Unfortunately, we live in a sexist culture which generates a great deal of feminine contempt and does so while hiding behind a manipulating sort of patronizing esteem. Can you put that up just a little bit further? It says, O woman, masterpiece of creation, queen of humanity, mother of the human race, take my boots off. This demeaning dynamic often anesthetizes the feminine spirit, so she is unable to challenge the agenda of the dominant culture that the dominant culture has for her without the fear of reprisal and rejection. Women who do not fit into the culture's pattern for females are marginalized, dismissed, and negatively labeled. I am going to call into question an ideal that many members of this culture consider a sacred cow, the ideal of being selfless. This attempt at deconstructing the cultural assumptions women have embraced by virtue of feigning a selfless personality is a challenging one. The cultural opposite of a selfless personality would be a selfish one, but the cultural issue of selfishness when applied to the feminine life is troubling. Ish is defined in the dictionary as, quote, of, pertaining to, or being, characteristic of, as in girlish, having the qualities of a girl, close quote. So selfish would be having the qualities and characteristics of yourself, manifesting attributes or traits of yourself, behaving in ways congruent and consistent with yourself. On the other hand, selfless is the condition of not having a self, doing what others want and expect of you. Our patriarchal United States culture wants women to be selfless because feminine selflessness comes in very handy when catering to the masculine personality. Thus, feminine selflessness is highly prized. A disclaimer, what I am not saying. I am not saying a woman should reject the social and religious roles provided by her culture, but I am persuaded that many need to awaken from the cultural trance of slumber. One needs to be awake to engage the heroine's journey of reclaiming the sacred inner landscape of the soul. The act of birthing, mothering, and marriage are heroic undertakings and of great value personally and culturally. But if a woman's own inner soul remains stillborn, abandoned, left an orphan, or never embraced in love due to the outer demands of living her culturally determined life, then a profound spiritual wound occurs. The pearl of great price, which is her unique and singular spirit, will never be realized and embraced. The masculine, religious, and secular cultures will never place a woman's spiritual awakening as an item of importance on its agenda. Rather, women are socialized to surrender their uniqueness of thought, feelings, and gifts for the deadened, homogenized, one-size-fits-all feminine gender role. I am proposing that a woman can fulfill her mortal responsibilities with creative, life-giving options that do not necessitate giving away her unique voice, personality, powers, intellects, goals, dreams, and spirituality. I believe what Carrie Miles, I believe what Carrie Miles wrote about the nature of our temporal, secular gender roles. Quote, anyone who has tried to live her life solely within the gender box knows that there is not enough room in there for a whole person, let alone a God. Close quote. I believe that women have a sacred obligation to go beyond their cultural socialization in reclaiming their sacred nature as equal companions in creation's truth. I do not believe God intended women to become a caricature of the fallen, secular role, happy mother, satisfied wife. Women have more to offer than stuffing themselves into the temporal cultural role play of womanhood, especially when that cultural role play invites a rejection of what may be most sacred and eternal about her, her own unique personality. Now, because of time constraints, I'm going to have to skip the middle portion of my paper, but I want to just kind of just give you an idea of what it may. The next part is a philosophical contradiction. And a philosophical contradiction is that any culture, whatever word is used over and over and over, and the example I use is, you've all heard of the Eskimos have, 28 different meanings or words to describe snow, because snow is very important. Now, on the assumption that if selflessness was really considered valuable in our culture, there would be very, you know, few selfless words. But in fact, I go to the dictionary and there are over 160 of them. When I looked up the word in the dictionary, I found over 160 self words beginning with self-abasement and ending with self-worship. If not having a self, which the cultural idea of selflessness implies, why does our society teem with the preoccupation of it? It doesn't add up. And the reason it doesn't add up is because we live in a dishonest society. Our society epitomizes self-indulgence, and most of us are unconsciously socialized to follow suit. For example, while men may preach the importance of selflessness, these same men have been socialized by the culture to pursue selfish interests. Men marinate in selfishness. From the time of boyhood, males are taught to seek out and obtain whatever they desire. Males have been trained in rugged individualism and steeped in competition, whether athletic, academic, romantic, financial, business, or religious. Every domain of the modern culture is fertile soil for men to display their superior competitive nature in, except involvement with the family, because that's woman's work. For men, the ish of self is accepted and promoted because each man is considered valuable and distinctive. While masculine socialization epitomizes selfish interests and endeavors, the feminine socialization is quite opposite. Women are socialized to meet other people's needs and are taught not to want anything more in life than masculine approval. This masculine approval is received in abundance if women are beautiful and willing to play the prescribed supportive feminine roles of girlfriend, wife, mother, house cleaner, cook, and lover. Many women seek out success in the culturally defined roles of womanhood so they can experience a sense of masculine defined significance. The problem is that many never nurture their own unique characteristics and gifts. Women in this culture are never considered individually distinctive and valuable, so the ish of self is substituted for the selflessness the cultural expectations required of them. Selffulness. If we think selfless is an appropriate spiritual condition to pursue, what would happen if we substituted the word soul for self? Would soulless be a spiritual condition worth seeking? I don't think so, but soulful would be. I want to introduce to you another self word that we never hear about. The word is self-full. Being self-full nurtures the sense of being grounded and conscious of one's potential and limits and having the courage to honor them both. Women have a sense of a self that is of divine origin. A self-full woman would be stable and not easily manipulated by her secular culture. She would be acquainted with her sacred center, protecting its spiritual nature and origins. Some have referred to Christ as being selfless, but I don't believe he was. I believe Christ was self-full. He knew who he was because it was given to him to know. Christ often retired by himself to commune with the heavens and to refill his own reserves. He gave of himself because of that fullness and shared with others his gifts of light and life. He stood up for himself and others when they were abused by the Jewish community before he finally surrendered himself to the plan of redemption. Christ was self-full and was and is more than willing to share that self with us through our own submission of being spiritually begotten of God. I believe God wants self-full women and men who are grounded and settled in compassion and mercy that have the courage to come and follow him on their spiritual paths. The shift. The paradigm shift I am exploring is a difficult thing to explain. In reclaiming the inner kingdom, the soul speaks from within, calling us to be the person we were born to be. It provides clues to our nature. These clues are sacred invitations that summon us to embrace and speak our own voice, our own truth. The soul speaks in safe and gentle ways, compelling us to grasp our gift of selfhood and care for the sacred essence it is. Having existed in other dimensions before coming to this earth, we brought with us our personality and gifts that were uniquely and originally ours. This gift of self was a result of potentially eons of timeless living and discovery. This self is our birthright. The body and spirit are the soul of woman. Just as each body is different and uncommon, each spirit is remarkable and unlike anything else in the world of creation. Joined together, they create a rare and matchless soul, but many women don't feel it. Too many women have been taught that they don't deserve a self or that selflessness is the best spiritual path to walk. This is wrong. We can't with integrity pretend that we are eternal and divine offspring of God and then foster content for being concerned about that eternal creation. Christ's principal command to love our neighbor as we love ourselves is often displaced by other peripheral concerns. I'm going to skip some. The conundrum I deal with, and I just want to explain what the conundrum is of service. What happens if somebody is getting depressed or not feeling good about themselves? They're told to go out and serve other people, thereby making themselves feel better. So it becomes a very self-serving kind of service. And there's something wrong when that occurs. I want to just give you one statement from this section. It's by the poet Anais Nin. She said, "I was always ashamed to take, so I gave. It was not a virtue, it was a disguise." When we wear other people's faces and live other people's lives, we lose our sense of unity and wholeness. Depression ultimately sets in. Depression is the eventual state of spiritual disengagement from yourself and from the adventure of life you were sent here to live. Adults or children. If women were grounded in themselves, they would be more resistant to the kinds of manipulation that our fallen culture, wonderful as it may be, has in store for them. In fact, grounded women would be difficult to control, and that would cause problems. Our culture does not want females to have a sense of self, because if they did, they would be differentiated, mature, and independent, which would cause all sorts of inconvenience for the males in charge of the culture. I think this is one of the most profound cartoons I have. The culture has an investment in maintaining the status quo of females acting as children. Thomas G. Plummer described this childlike condition known as the Ophelia syndrome. The Ophelia syndrome is being chronically ignorant, dependent, and submissive. One who is an adult but chooses to be a baby. One who does not know her own opinions, and one who would not express them to an authority if she did. Many females may not be sensitive to the fact that our culture's gender roles are based upon a parent-child structure. Sociologist Irving Goffman explains, quote, "Gender relationships are patterned on the parent-child complex. In other words, men are to women as adults are to children, loving protectors who will hold open doors, offer the first portion of sweets, reach high shelves, and lift heavy loads. But along with the privileges of childhood come liabilities. Children's activities are interruptible, their time and territory expendable. Along with the privileges of being protected comes the loss of rights and not being respected and treated like a full-fledged person. Being the protector frames someone as competent, capable, capable, and deserving of respect. Being protected frames one as incompetent, incapable, and deserving of indulgence. Close quote. This childlike stance is antithetical to being a mature spiritual woman with a voice. But in fairness, some women love to be indulged, protected, taken care of, treated special, etc. Nevertheless, problems arise when these same women want to be taken seriously as a respected equal partner in a relationship. They are more often than not patronized, ignored, or dismissed with authoritative pulling of masculine rank. Trust me. The doctrinal oneness of man-woman relationship in the eternal world does not square at all with this notion of parent-child relationship. Conclusion, the invitation of the inner kingdom. Do not let a perverse culture shame you out of the spiritual heritage that is yourself. The invitation to reclaim the inner kingdom of your soul is a spiritual pilgrimage, a transformative adventure to a sacred place deep within you. The healing powers of Christ can unify the displaced and fragmented soul, leading it through the labyrinth of the spiritual journey. But some, understandably, do not want to make the trip. As the entertainer Cher has suggested, romance and work are great diversions to keep you from dealing with yourself. Nevertheless, sometime in your life you will receive an invitation to return to yourself. It may come in the form of a dream, a symposium, or a book. The invitation may come in the quiet desperation of your soul's fight for wholeness. It may come as an invitation from another who is on the path of selfhood, or it may bubble up in your own heart as a result of living a life that you know is not your own. The invitation to reclaim all of yourself will come to you when your soul is ready. You cannot force the season. When the call comes, it will usually be associated with uncomfortable paradigm shifts that challenge the beliefs you have about yourself. It is an offense that we are not better acquainted with the spiritual adventure of awakening from the cultural trance of slumber, so that women could be urged on and supported and undertaken, arguably, the most important spiritual odyssey of their lives. The transition from self-contempt to intimate compassion will be realized with the embrace of your own inner kingdom. The ability to reclaim your true identity is a spiritual work. It is a metaphorical awakening to another reality. It is a heroine's adventure. If you were stripped of all your roles, who or what would be left of you? Take away your name, your work, your role of wife, mother, or girlfriend, your education, family, reputation, your spouse or lover. Who would you be? I think the work of identity is an excruciating spiritual enterprise which will forever change your sense of self and the people you share your life with. When you receive this invitation to explore your inner kingdom, I hope you will remember and have hope in this promise. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear. When the time is right, someone or something will come into your life and will point you in the right direction, giving you a little push while whispering, "Go that way." I hope you have the faith to go, because God will have sent the teacher. I end with a poem, Within, written by Carol Lynn Pearson. I read a map once saying the kingdom of God was within me, but I never trusted such unlikely ground. I went out. I scoured schools and libraries and chapels and temples and other people's eyes and the skies and the rocks, and I found treasures from the kingdom's treasury, but not the kingdom. Finally, I came in quiet for a rest and turned on the light. And there, just like a surprise party, was all the smiling royalty, king, queen, court. People have been, I know, locked up for less. But I tell you, something marvelous is bordered by this skin. I am a castle, and the kingdom of God is within.
I appreciated that very much. Actually, that the imagery from that final poem may make kind of a nice segue into what I want to talk about today. Part of my own spiritual journey, going within myself, and so to speak. So today I'm going to speak about silence as a spiritual practice. In thinking about how to talk about this, I was a little bit frustrated considering that I want to talk about what it means not to talk and why I enjoy being quiet and silent and why that's become an important part of my journey. So over the past 2 years, my spiritual journey has taken me from a lifestyle of full committed church activity, regular temple attendance, teaching seminary, and working as a media specialist for public affairs, et cetera, to where I am now, finding spiritual growth as a contemplative Quaker. While this is a radical journey in many respects, I'll speak today about an aspect of my life that in some ways hasn't changed much, my practice of contemplation, meditation, spirit-seeking, and personal revelation through silence. As an active LDS member, I often sought the guidance of the Spirit in my callings and in making decisions. When I was faced with a challenge, I went to the temple, enjoying the familiarity of the ritual and spending much time in the celestial room after each session, sitting there in prayer and contemplation, feeling removed from the world and in a space where I felt a more pure communication with the divine. As I attended the Los Angeles Temple, I truly appreciated the deep peace I found within its walls as I contrasted the surrounding urban hustle and bustle of Santa Monica Boulevard with the tranquility I felt deep inside those inner sanctums of the temple. There I felt untouched by the world, apart, holy, and whole. In some ways, a Quaker meeting couldn't be more different than an endowment session. Quakers embrace simplicity. They meet in unadorned buildings and worship by sitting in a room in a circle of chairs. Each individual enters the room in silence, and the silence continues until someone feels motivated to share a thought or a feeling with the group. Generally, silence continues for most of the hour, with only a few friends standing to share thoughts, perhaps 5 minutes out of an entire hour of silence. So I want to share with you something I wrote after attending my first few Quaker worship meetings. At my first Quaker meeting, I felt a bit awkward, as I feel with anything new. John, my husband, who had been before, explained a bit about Quaker silent worship to me. "Just sit and meditate," he said. "Every once in a while, someone will feel prompted to speak, like in testimony meeting." I wasn't quite prepared for the simplicity of the room where we would sit and worship. It was like a Relief Society room with no flowered curtains, no pulpit, no table, no pictures on the walls. Just chairs in a circle in this large plain room, about half of them occupied with a wide variety of people. Many were older, almost all wore pants. Nearly everyone wore sandals on their feet, which was certainly a far cry from the fanciness of the saints in my Orange County ward. As I seated myself and settled into silence, I tried to quiet my mind and think godly thoughts. As I did so, with insistence, the temple ceremony came to my mind. I found myself walking through each step of the washing and anointing. I smiled as I imagined myself looking into the eyes of the temple workers who were administering the ordinances. I moved on through the endowment and soon found myself seated in the celestial room. Warmth and light filled my chest as I reflected on the many hours that I had spent praying and basking in the Spirit within that special space of the temple. When I was in doubt about a month before my marriage, I was wholeheartedly enthusiastic about the temple. John and I attended at least half a dozen times before our actual marriage ceremony. Then we arranged to stay in the temple apartment for the last part of our honeymoon so we could go through several sessions per day. Throughout that first year of our marriage, we attended nearly every week. We would arise at 4:30 on Saturday morning so we could make the 40-mile drive to LA without traffic and catch the sunrise from a sealing room in the temple. And then we would go to breakfast in the temple and share a cup of custard or slice of pie. So why was I reliving all of this in my mind at the Quaker meeting? I didn't know at the time, and I learned not to fight it. As I continued to attend silent worship week after week, I had the same experience. And like the warm, fuzzy feelings that I'd had in the temple prior to that, I would leave meeting with a giddiness and ebullience that rather frightened me. I liked the feelings, but I was scared to question too deeply why it felt so good to be there, to worship that way. Now, I believe I understand why the temple figured so importantly in my early silent worship experiences. because up to that point in my life, if I sought that direct communication with God or communion with God, I had sought him in the temple. Or even before I was in doubt, I would go to temple grounds and sit in the gardens outside. And so now as I have practiced with the Quakers, I've learned to do this without needing the temple ritual to get that same closeness to the Spirit. So I want to just share one quotation with you from George Fox, who's the founder of Quakerism. He wrote this about the temple. "The Lord showed me, so that I did see clearly, that he did not dwell in these temples which men had commanded and set up, but in people's hearts. His people were his temple, and he dwelt in them." And that quotation has been important to me as I've thought about transitioning out of the church and what the temple had meant to me before, and understanding that I could find that within myself and that I no longer needed the ritual and that space to feel that same way. Now, in addition to the practice of worshiping in a group with Quakers each week, on Sundays I find myself craving periods of silent worship every day. I meditate quietly as I go through showering, my grooming ritual each morning, and I spend many evenings in quiet contemplation in my garden. I just missed something. When I have moments where I find myself waiting for something, in line at the store, waiting for a delayed plane flight, or arriving a bit too early to pick up my children from school, I enjoy the silence instead of immediately reaching for a magazine or flipping open my cell phone to make a call. Worshipful silence is a practice that is so simple. It can be enjoyed by anyone, anywhere. Even in the midst of noise, one can find space for peace and contemplation. This silent meditation may involve a plea to God, or may be reflective self-introspection. Sometimes it is a period of emptying your mind and letting yourself just be fully present in that moment. In any of these cases, silence is for everyone, Mormon, Quaker, atheist, humanist, or anyone anywhere else on the spectrum of belief. Thank you.
Gosh, ever since Doe asked me to talk about maybe 2 weeks ago, I have had so much feelings of angst and negativity about it, and it's taken me a while to put words and feelings, get some clarity about it. And one of the reasons it's here just occurred to me in the last hour, and it's I'm not usually emotional, but anyway. And that is, this morning I went to Margaret Toscano's, the panel, talking about her boys and girls treated equally in the church. And I had an insight occur to me an hour ago, which I'm sure other people have thought of, but I had not, is to one of the costs of women not holding the priesthood in the church. And that is that during this whole time, in the last 2 weeks when I've been thinking about this talk, I would go to write it down. I would go to write down ideas, and my mind would fly all over the place, and I was almost constrained that I could not write down what I was supposed to say. And I, so many attempts, and I realized I have to rely on the Spirit. And the cost that came as a result, me realizing, because I've not had the priesthood, 30 years ago when I, or no, actually not quite 30, when I went on a mission, I have never, had to give a confirmation blessing, without a pre-written thing. I've never had to lay my hands on someone's head and trust that the Lord will give me those words to speak. And to me that's sad, because I have to make this fumbling attempt at 49 years old, having been active in the church my whole life, to never really having experience other than, say, testimony meeting. But for some reason this was more traumatic than testimony meeting. So I don't know, I'm not articulating that very well, but I thought that's sad that, as a missionary, I definitely would have given confirmation. I would have, given healing blessings. This would not have been so traumatic. The other reason I think this was sort of full of all kinds of negative emotions is what I'm about to talk about is somewhat heretical, not at Sunstone, but in the church. The main belief I'm going to talk about has been called a fallacy by the Brethren in modern revelation, or in modern, more modern day than Joseph Smith. In fact, Joseph Smith taught the main focus of my little talk today. He called it the doctrine of eternal lies, and Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball called this doctrine, I think, multiple mortal probations. And just so you have a little background, I remember. I have been such the conforming Mormon, and I remember maybe 16, 17 years ago, my brother Dan told me he was going to get his PhD in theology. I looked at him like, why? You know, why go outside the church? We're Mormon. All the truths contained in Mormon doctrine. Why would you need to study theology? Well, 10 years ago, I had an experience that totally put me on a little detour path or an unpaved road where I felt like I've had to be a pioneer. And now I totally get it. I have totally way opened up my worldview, way become much more broad-minded. And it's been an exciting journey, but as any pioneer knows, it can be tough. And it started 10 years ago, nothing out of the ordinary. I had just gotten divorced, and I was thinking about going back to school, not quite sure what to do with my life, or I'd actually planned on going back to school, and I was reading, happened to be in a car waiting for a friend to mail some packages, and I was kind of bored, so I reached in my purse looking for something to read, and all I had in there, I had my patriarchal blessing, and I just pulled it out like normal, and just after a few paragraphs, all of a sudden, I just had this voice. It's just my inner voice, like normal, come so strongly. Never had an impression come so strongly. Basically just brought an experience quickly to my mind and said, you've done this before on this earth. I mean, I was so blindsided by that. That reincarnation was a reality. I mean, I was sick in my stomach for like three days. I actually went to the San Diego Temple to just go hang out on the grounds because it was closed. It was over a weekend, and I just had to be there to say, "Are you sure this is true? I've never, heard of this. What all I knew about it, I, read a few sentences in a textbook. I was not asking for that. I had not been worried about whether it was true or not. But it came, and then I remember after I left the temple, I was prompted to go over across the street to the mall and walk into the bookstore. And I found myself standing right in front of the New Age section. And that was a section of the books I had always, avoided. I felt, that's evil. We're supposed to leave that stuff alone. And I found myself standing in front of it, and the Spirit coming very strongly, "Sharon, you have a lot of catching up to do." So from that moment on, I have not felt any book in the world is barred for me to read. I don't usually read them all. I have never felt that I couldn't expose myself to any practice. I have not become like a master or joined any, real groups. I've been to a few shamanic sessions and where there's drumming. I've been to a few winter solstice parties where we honor, the solstice, and goddess rituals, just in a friend's house. I mean, I'm not afraid to expose myself. I've had a tarot reading quickly. Someone's read my palm quickly. I mean, it's just something where I became aware that those things, that there is some truth to all those things, and the Spirit helps me kind of glean, what's true and maybe what's a little bit off. But I used to just think that, when the second coming came, only that Christ would reveal all this brand new stuff. And I became more aware that there's a lot of truth already here. And I haven't had any trouble really reconciling it with my Mormon beliefs because our church is so, from the foundations, it does have an open canon. It does have a fluid theology. And, right now it's gotten a little slow, and maybe the new doctrine's coming and stuff. But the pattern is there. It really is. For, to to incorporate all this truth. And, you know, and I did happen to mention to my bishop early on, which was kind of naive and probably kind of stupid, that I did have a belief in reincarnation. And you know, he didn't take it too well. He actually did say to me, "You're a woman. Why would the Lord reveal that to you?" And I said, I don't know, but I can't deny it. I said, were I to deny it, I would be denying the Holy Ghost, and I refuse to go there. And, you know, if my membership were to be in question, I would gladly give it up. I am that confident, and that confident that it came from the Lord. And it's something that I needed to lead me on a path to where I needed to be. And I think that's because, you know, when we know that there will be more revelation, and many of you in the room have, you know, are in doing things that are a little more unorthodox. And I just have the sense that some of us will be there to, you know, help support the rest of the people when they have kind of the trauma of realizing some truth. I mean, I've always known, you know, the Jews are going to have the trauma of realizing they crucified their Messiah. You know, that's in our doctrine, that they're going to have to take on Christ. And, you know, every major religion's going to have to give up some of their maybe core or, you know, beliefs. And I never thought that Mormons might, that we might have to add something that would be traumatic. And so I feel like some people in all walks of life or whatever are prepared to help maybe ease the pain for some of the others, you know, because it is painful. It was painful when the blacks got the priesthood. It was painful for some. I mean, that's the only, you know, reason I can guess. I don't think I'm anything special, but it was something I did not seek after. Completely caught me off guard. But it's something that I am grateful for because it's, you know, helped me on my spiritual path. Thank you.
Hi, and thank you all for coming. My name is Kathy Wilson. I wasn't born in Salt Lake, but I've lived here my whole life. I'll give you a little bit of background about growing up in Salt Lake City for some of you who haven't, and a little bit about the different transitions that I've made in my own personal life. Salt Lake was a small city when we were growing up, and we grew up in Liberty Park, Fairmont Park. I had a lot of freedom, attended Salt Lake City schools, graduated from South High School, attended the University of Utah for a couple of years before I got married, started having children. My husband then, Ted, and I lived in Switzerland for a year, came back. He was a teacher for a while, ran for office when I was still quite young. We had probably about four children when he was elected mayor of Salt Lake City, and I was 30 years old, maybe 31. So for 10 years, between the ages of 30 and 40, I was the mayor's wife of Salt Lake City, and raising five children at the same time, being a political wife. At one point, I had, I think, about seven or eight businesses, because I had friends who liked to do different things and wanted to start a business, and I had had a couple of art galleries and some other little businesses, and so I did it, you know, as a diversion. I was always a stay-at-home mom when I needed to be, but I was always out the door, you know, doing all these other things at the same time. I had to give up my painting for a few years because I had so many other distractions, like five kids and a political husband and fundraisers and everything else. But through all of this period of time in my life, I was very supportive, and I knew that I was making choices that were important choices, and that they were my choices. I chose to be a mother, I chose to be a wife, and I chose to be supportive. And I look back at those years, and I wouldn't have had it any other way. I had one gift after another to help me down my path. I think I was a pretty good mother. I think I was a pretty good wife. I wasn't the greatest political wife because I wasn't there by Ted's side all the time, you know, patting him on the back, telling him what a great person he was, what a great mayor he was. But I was realistic, and I helped him do the best job he knew how to do. After our last son went on a mission, I had known this for a few years. Ted has a totally different personality than I do, and we have been best friends our whole lives, or since we met each other. He has a certain way of looking about what he does in his life and who he is, and I have my own. Well, it was exactly as Michael was talking about. You reach a point, and you have to be a genuine person. Once my children were gone, and I didn't have to be a mother, a stay-at-home mother, and I didn't even have to, you know, I didn't care whether what the house looked like at that point. And Ted was, you know, doing the things that he had always done and loved doing, teaching and getting involved in a lot of community things. And I could be supportive of a lot of things, but I was tired of ball games. And I was tired of, you know, some of the same old social groups and politics and some of the outdoor things that he liked and motorcycles and whatever. And gradually over the years, I realized, you know, I can still be Ted's best friend. He can still be my best friend, but we don't have to be married. And that's not who I am anymore. And I had to make those difficult decisions that Michael was talking about. I had to be true to myself. And it was very, very difficult because I gave up a lot. I gave up a social life. I gave up credibility because who would, you know, we had the perfect marriage, the perfect family, the perfect lifestyle. Who would give that up? And I gave it up because I had to be who I was. I'm totally happy with every decision that I've made. I haven't, and Ted and I are still very, very close friends. It hasn't been easy for him. It hasn't been easy for me. It wasn't easy for our children. But everybody has grown. We're better people. I'm a more authentic person, and I have the freedom to do what I need to do. One of the things that I've done... And it's really interesting because I think Michael and I have been listening to the same channelers or something. But the self-fullness was a very, very important aspect for me because I knew that I had to do what I was doing. But I didn't realize that I wasn't self-full, that there was a part of me that I had to build up. It wasn't that I was selfish or that I was selfless, but there was a part of me that wasn't fulfilled, and I had to find out how to do that. And a lot of it is through silence. A lot of it is through being guided to receive the information, open yourself up to fill your soul with the information and the love that is available to you. And so I started reading. I was guided to read all kinds of information, everything about reincarnation, everything about the New Age movement, everything about channeling. I have got a list of 100 people who receive channeled information and who are trying to help people through this new paradigm change that Michael has been talking about. And we truly are going through a paradigm change. I've been doing this for 15 years. And I know that when I first started to get involved in this, I was out there on the edge. And I wasn't sure how sane I was at times because there was nobody around me that I could talk to about the things that were happening to me. There was just nobody there. So luckily for me and for others in this community, there was Golden Braid. And so I would go down and kind of go through the bookshelves and kind of pick out a piece. And, you know, I was almost guided to pick up the right pieces. And so over the years, I have a much better feeling of who I am. What my what my path is, what my gift is to other people, what how to pull in that support from my higher self. I call it my higher self, or a spiritual support system. And I think each of us, when we get to that point in our life where we really need it, there are support systems that we don't have a clue about. And what we have to do is learn what is available and how to access it. And what I'm still doing is learning how to access that. And I don't have very many bad days anymore, because I have learned that if I'm not in balance, I can be in peace and quiet, and I can learn to balance. And all the parts of me, and I know there are many parts of me, can come into alignment, and then I can be the person that I want to be. I've overcome some very incredible pulls in my emotions in the last few years. Energies that I had no clue were even out there. And it's a way I know that from a higher perspective, I have given myself these opportunities to strengthen myself and to do the things that I need to do to go on. And like many, many of us in this room, prepare the way for other people who will be making a transition into a new paradigm. I hope that I hope I'm guided. I hope I listen to the guides that are there for me. I hope I'm capable of being everything that my higher self and the plan for my life is. And I want to be of service. So thank you very much.
I am one of those New Age Mormons that Doe is always talking about. And I say this with the caveat that I agree 100% with feminist scholar Monica Shue's criticism of the patriarchal aspects of the New Age movement. And her name is spelled S-J-O-O if you want to Google it. I use tarot and other forms of divination. But then again, I'm also able to read signs and omens for myself. Probably due to the second sight my mother told me as a child I might inherit, as she did from her grandmothers. I am in a women's spirituality master's degree program where I study subjects like ancient and contemporary female shamanism and ancient and contemporary matriarchal cultures. I feel that my work in women's spirituality is my own contribution to the restoration of all things. I don't believe the restoration ended with the death of Joseph Smith, and suspect that the bulk of the restoration may have yet to take place. I am also a Mormon who practices Tibetan Buddhism. So I may be coming at this from a slightly different angle than other New Age Mormons, because I don't see my activities as necessarily being outside the scope of Mormonism. I've often wondered if it's possible that this idea of a New Age is a non-Mormon way of perceiving and describing the dispensation of the fullness of times. Did Joseph Smith himself usher in this New Age? It has been taught in the Mormon tradition that the world's religions were all descended from a common source. See Hunter's The Gospel Through the Ages. As a restorationist, I feel like we should continually expect new information, such as archaeological discoveries. In example, the Nag Hammadi Library, or the light archaeologist Maria Gimbutas shed on old Europe's prehistoric, goddess-centered matriarchal cultures. As a Mormon, it feels natural to be reviving lost or suppressed knowledge and practices, as well as discovering and receiving new ones. Brigham Young once said, "I can tell you in a few words what I understand Mormonism to be. It embraces every fact there is in the heavens and in the heaven of heavens, every fact there is on the surface of the earth, in the bowels of the earth, and in the starry heavens. In fine, it embraces all truth there is in all the eternities of the gods, Mormonism embraces all truth that is revealed and that is unrevealed, whether religious, political, scientific, or philosophical. Joseph Smith once said, "The most prominent difference in sentiment between the Latter-day Saints and sectarians was that the latter were all circumscribed by some peculiar creed, which deprived its members of the privilege of believing anything not contained therein, whereas the Latter-day Saints have no creed, but are ready to believe all true principles that exist as they are made manifest from time to time." And McConkie's Gospel Doctrine states, "As rivers flow into an ocean, all the dispensations of the past flow into this, the final great dispensation." So, this is my testimony of the restoration of all things, in this, the dispensation of the fullness of times. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
I really didn't intend to say anything, but now I feel like I just have to. And that is how much I just want to acknowledge everyone on our panel, how grateful I am that you were all willing to come and be a part of this. It seems as if our task in this life is to figure out how to live a life that we love, given our lives. And like just about everybody here, it seems like that has been what I've been up to as well, trying to, waking up one day and realizing, oh, what's wrong with me is that I'm not living a life that I love. What would that look like? What does that mean? And the power that is in stepping on that path is just utterly impossible to articulate, and it's full of pain and it's full of anxiety sometimes, but it's really the most rewarding way to live. So I guess I would like to just thank you for coming. I want to open this up for questions. What time are we supposed to be over?
30 minutes.
Oh, wow, we've got 30 minutes. That's great. Well, then I'll go ahead and do my little plug for my project. I guess it's not really a plug, but I'm going to put these cards up here so when you're all done, you can come and take a card if you're interested in talking with me. It kind of describes my dissertation project. And so I'll open up questions. If you'll please come to the microphone so that, yes.
Did you discuss your dissertation project because I was late?
A little bit. Oh, okay, all right. Well, what it is I'm looking at popular religion amongst New Age, amongst Mormons, people with Mormon backgrounds. They don't have to be active in the LDS Church, but just so long as they have some sort of background in Mormonism. I'm looking for people who... I'm especially interested in talking with women, although I am also interested in talking with men. My primary focus is going to be on women who have had experiences like Sharon described, who find their experiences or the paths that they're taking, the practices or beliefs that they've come to recognize as true, that they find those completely congruent within the Mormon context. And then others who don't. I guess what I'm really interested in is the threads that survive, you know, or the ways in which Mormonism and the Mormon worldview informs people's religious beliefs and practices. So if you meditate, how did you get to where you meditated? You know, what caused you to begin meditating? What was that journey like? What's that life been like? If you do astrology or visit an astrologist, you know, how is that something that you see completely outside of the Mormon worldview, or is that informed somehow and congruent with what you consider to be your Mormon worldview? If you engage in any sort of veneration of the goddess or earth-based ritual, does Heavenly Mother follow you into that? You know, does that seem congruent with you to you because you come out of a tradition that has a Heavenly Mother? If you do energy work, if you do Reiki or crystal healing or something like that, you know, is there a Mormon thread to that based on what we believe about the, you know, human capacity and the way energy works in the world? So that's really what I'm up to. And basically the card reads like this. If you are at least 18, oh man, I had to fill out all kinds of forms, you know, and go before a board. And I'm not going to hurt anybody. If you have a background in Mormonism, if you believe in reincarnation, channeling, goddesses, and or astrology, etc., etc., if you've ever practiced holistic health, divination, or meditation, etc., etc., call or write to participate in a research project that takes a sympathetic look. I'm not looking to, like, debunk this. This is my path. I'm looking at my people. A sympathetic look at these and other popular spiritual practices and beliefs among people with LDS backgrounds. And I'm with the Arizona State University Department of Religious Studies. I'm a PhD candidate, which means all I have to do is write my dissertation, and so I'm starting on that project now. And I thought this was the greatest place because ever since, Lisa Hansen's, I guess, her first presentation here, she does past life regression and hypnotherapy. I was on a panel that she created about human potential. It didn't have anything to do with New Age, but that's really what we showed up to talk about, the human potential. And Carolyn Pearson was there, and Dan spoke on that panel as well. And ever since then, virtually every year, I've been a part of some type of panel that looks at these practices and these beliefs and the way this gets expressed in Mormonism. And so that's what's led me to this project. So.
I missed what you said. Is this for what school are you looking at?
Arizona State University, Department of Religious Studies in Religious Studies, in Tempe, Arizona. So, if you have questions, step up to the microphone and ask them, and direct them to
for Elizabeth.
Okay.
If you could, I'm wondering how you got into Tibetan Buddhism. How did you get into Tibetan Buddhism, and can you give us an idea of what is involved?
Specifically, well, I've always had just a general spiritual resonance, but actually there is... there is a man in a great Mormon scholar out in cyberspace that I know named Kenneth Shaw from Texas. And he noted many years ago the parallels actually between a tradition within Tibetan Buddhism called where there is a person called Tertön, and they will bury a treasure, like, on golden plates with spiritual writings on it. It might have, like, a magical language. And then it's meant for a Tertön or a prophet in the future to go and through spiritual guidance will be led to go and unbury this treasure at a future point in order to, you know, better or improve the world with this spiritual knowledge that's been set aside for a future time when it will be needed. So there is this really, quite a few profound parallels between Tibetan Buddhism and the Mormon tradition. Yeah. So, and also another thing that I find interesting in my study, my comparative study of Tibetan Buddhism and Mormonism, is that the cosmology, Buddhist cosmology, I feel, and Mormon cosmology, I feel, shed a great deal of light on each other, that they're incredibly compatible, and that if you look at them side by side, that I think it almost brings both of them into sort of a richer view or understanding. So that's just a little bit.
Are there some disciplines
Yes, I do attend the Shambhala Meditation Center in Davis, California, and that's an international organization that was started by the Venerable Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He was one of the primary Buddhists that brought Buddhism or brought the Dharma to America. And
the question was, there are some disciplines that you do, like
I do sitting meditation, and then I also, one of my professors at New College of California is Vicki Noble, and she practices Tibetan Buddhism. She studied under Soltram Alioni, and she gave me a Dakini practice that I also do on a daily basis.
I'd also like to kind of insert a little anecdote, a personal experience. You've met the Dalai Lama, right? No, okay. Who was I talking to? It was you, okay. It was you. this is another, like, step on this path when you have an experience that is so profound that you, like Sharon had, that you can't deny, but it's so bizarre, right? And so I had the opportunity to come to L.A. to be a part of a group that witnessed the Dalai Lama conferring I guess it's an annual award on someone. I can't remember who got it that year. Maybe it was Richard Gere. I can't remember. Anyway, so all these great people were there. But when this man walked into the room and walked past me, and I didn't touch him, I didn't speak to him, I didn't, you know, but there was something in me that opened up that I thought had been closed forever. And that kind of an experience was just, that experience was so profound that I'll never forget it. And I forget lots of stuff. Those of you who, you know, I've met you many times and and I can't remember your name and I'm not sure where I met you. But, I mean, this, I'll never forget this. What I felt when that man just walked past me and it opened me up in a way that made me a different human being with my children, with my husband, with the people I worked with. And so that has been just one integral piece of this journey that just nudged me a little bit on that road instead of that road.
This is the nature of my life. I think that you'll find this valuable. I own two purses, okay? Both of them have a picture of the Buddha on these purses. And one of the purses has a picture of a Chinese Buddha. The other purse has a picture of a Tibetan Buddha. Well, one Sunday, I went to church. I was a Sunday school primary teacher, and I brought my Tibetan Buddhist purse with me. I had never before or since brought either Buddha purse with me to church. The one Sunday that I brought the Tibetan Buddhist purse with me to church, the sister missionaries had brought a Tibetan Buddhist monk to church that Sunday. So I showed him my purse. Like, look, you know, it's a Tibetan Buddhist purse in the LDS church, and you're a Tibetan monk, and here we are. And so I just wanted to add in that with this Terma tradition, it's worth looking into. Look it up on the internet or something, because I have a whole book on this. And when you actually read about this Terma, Tibetan Terma, you know, treasure burying tradition, it just reads like the Joseph Smith story. I mean, even with details to where the Terton who goes to unbury these golden plates that might be buried in the ground, or there's different types of Terma treasures, but one is an earth-based, you know, Terma treasure, and that he has to have the proper tantric consorts, the proper, you know, if it's a male, he has to have the proper female consort. And I read things like this, and I think about how Joseph Smith was told before he could go and unbury the plates that he had to have the right person with him, and that person turned out to be Emma Smith. So, anyway. I'm so sorry. What I wanted to finalize that thought with was, I think about the Tibetan monk who was in the LDS chapel who saw my purse. I feel like if people from a tradition, say like the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, say knew or had actually heard about the Joseph Smith story, they might actually recognize it as their own.
I don't quite know how to phrase this question statement. My personal philosophy is more like Elizabeth's, that when I hear about other events, other feelings, other experiences that people have, I try to put it into, how does it fit in with my philosophy of Mormonism? Is it in this truth umbrella? How wide is that umbrella? So what I'm wondering about is, in all of your experiences, what is it that you can accept within that umbrella, or where is the point that you say, I've got to make the break away from the Mormon Church in order to accept my own personal truth?
I don't attend the Mormon Church regularly, but there's nothing in the Mormon Church that I would really disagree with, other than the fact that they're still learning, like all of us are. And I think and hope that as the Mormon Church evolves, as we evolve, that they understand the inequities of some of the policies, the stupidity of a lot of them, and how much the organization itself is losing out by not broadening their viewpoint at this point. I attribute it to the old way of thinking, a leadership from men in their 90s. Obviously, most of us feel this way. I think it's going to take some jarring of a lot of things for leadership within the church to open up to kind of a new concept, a whole new way of thinking. How I feel about the church, moving forward, I see it in little teeny bits and pieces. I have a daughter who's active in the church, who is very fair and you know, basically very aware. I see her friends that are still in the church being leaders in their wards, in their communities. I have a very active son who has always looked at rules to be analyzed and challenged if they're not fair. I see as people take their own experience, I see the church changing and growing just like we are. I don't personally find anything within the church organization to benefit me personally, so I can be supportive at a distance. I do a lot of other things that are, I think, much more beneficial for my time, but I don't think there's a better organization in the world to spread good intent. I think missionaries are out there with good intent. I think that our servicemen who are Mormons, who are anywhere in the world, have good intent. I just hope and pray that we, as a culture, as a church, as members of the Mormon Church, can not throw the baby out with the bathwater, but to encourage change in the best way possible.
I guess my answer to that question is that Mormonism tends to value right practice over right belief. And so we're really free to believe whatever we want, so long as we, you know, practice a particular way. However, that's institutional practice. And so I guess for me, the biggest thing was when I started taking part in women's rituals. And so that's really crossing a line, you know. But it was also, for me, it felt like it was anyway. At the same time, I mean, what I got from that was the experience of officiating that I'd never, ever had. That's incredibly, I get it now. I really get that now, how incredible that feeling is. I mean, there's nothing more empowering than that in that context, you know. And so... but at the same time, that has nothing to do with Mormonism. So I'm not sure that I feel that I've broken off from Mormonism, but, I mean, it's not something I'd go into the chapel and expect to be able to do. So I think maybe thinking about it in terms of the difference between belief and practice, and, I mean, there are a lot of people at church that hold a lot of interesting beliefs that are or consider themselves, you know, 100% believing Mormons. And so that's interesting, believing Mormons. So anyway, that might be helpful.
That's an excellent question, and I think it comes down to how we define truth. And in a typical Mormon audience, you ask, well, what's the definition for truth? Then you get the knowledge of things as they are and as they were and as they are to come. Except that that verse is taken out of context. If you want an interesting, that's a middle of a sentence. We never bother to quote the first part of the sentence, and we don't bother to quote the end of the sentence, which is the verse before it and the verse after it. My definition of truth is simply you and me. We are packets of intelligence, of frequency, and how we resonate with one another. And as I have struggled at times with the institution, I've also had to conclude that this is my culture. These are my people. I can leave these people for another group, and I will find the same issues, because I do not believe what needs to be healed is out here. I believe it's in here. And I think once I deal with the healing that occurs in here, everything else pretty much takes care of itself. And it's so easy to project upon other people, marriage partners, friends, church leaders, whoever. But the issue is that the healing that needs to occur is within my own heart. And the Eastern idea of everything else is just kind of illusionary. And let it go.
Can you tell us about which verse are you talking about?
It's DNC 93:23 is the one that that's always quoted as truth. And I'm just astounded. I mean, that it's like nobody catches on that we're taking it out of context. Not only out of the section, but out of the middle of a sentence that we don't bother to even...
So can you remember what precedes it? Can you tell us?
Well, I can paraphrase it. Yeah. Ye were also in the beginning with God. The spirit or light of truth wasn't created. And truth is knowledge of things as they are, as they were and as they are to come. And anything more or less than this is of Satan, is of the devil, is false. And this idea is that truth is talking about you and me. We are these spirits of truth, this intelligence that...
This comment's not as profound, but I always, you know, think of what Joseph Smith said, that truth is independent in its own sphere. Yeah, truth, to me, I remember what Joseph Smith said, that truth is independent in its own sphere, and that helps me reconcile things that maybe seem in conflict, or another way to put that is what the lies change at every level, you know. I don't begrudge, you know, more modern general authorities for saying that, say, reincarnation is a fallacy. That's their truth. To me, it was very important in the last few hundred years that this belief is not generally practiced, because it offered us all kinds of more opportunities for growth. I empathize with, you know, with, say, you know, Mormon parents who have a wayward child or a gay child or something, because I think that process of grieving over that lost soul, of worrying that even though it's an illusion, and that's, you know, I'm a little Buddhist or whatever stuff. I mean, I definitely see there's, you know, way lots of truth in those Eastern religions, but it is an illusion. But yet, you know, I think we come here to experience, you know, to be prepared for gods, to be for godhood, and part of being a god, you know, is to watch your wayward children go astray, and you know, it gives us empathy for what God the Father felt like. And if we believed in reincarnation, we would be robbed of that learning experience. and many other things. And plus, a lot of people, you know, just would kind of cruise through life and not take it as seriously. So I have no problem with right now. It's veiled from the general membership. That's okay with me because, you know, it's our truth for right now. But there's many levels to truth, and you know, I tend to be, you know, real patient, and I know it'll all be sorted out eventually. And the other thing, and it's true, the more I learn, the more, you know, the less I know, and I have found that. But that's okay.
Can I make a comment? I just the last month or so, I discovered a book called Conversations with Tom. I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, but it sounds to me like it's something that an LDS theology would accept, because he was telling her husband who had passed away, she was in touch with him. He told her that not to worry, because she would say, well, when I get up to heaven, will you be reincarnated and gone somewhere? Would I be able to be with you again, or what's going to happen? He said, no, I will be here. And I can't remember how he put it, but in so many words that what brought to my mind something that I had read elsewhere, like some of the Michael books, that Michael is an entity of like 2,000 persons. And when Edgar Casey did his readings, he would say, after that lifetime, the entity gained or the entity lost. And so it could be, and I heard LDS sources say that reincarnation doesn't work exactly that way. That's why we reject it. The entity, you are not just you, but you and a bunch of others that make one unit of some sort. I don't know what to call it. And so maybe reincarnation will finally be accepted by the church if they can, you know, this point is brought up. It's never brought up by anybody else that I know of. Anyway, appreciate you.
Have just a little story about reincarnation and resurrection. But my husband and I were on a mission in Thailand for a year and a half, and we lived totally for 18 months with Buddhist people. And we got to know a lot about the Buddhist religion, which we knew nothing about until we went there. It was a wonderful learning experience. The Buddhist people there in Thailand are we never got into downtown Bangkok, and we never knew anything about all of the bad things that go on in Bangkok. We were in the western edge of Bangkok, and what we were doing was teaching government teachers how to teach English. They had degrees in English, but they'd never heard it spoken, and so they couldn't teach it. And my husband and I were responsible for doing this in 46 schools. And I just like to tell you that this, and all of these people, Buddhism was taught in the schools. In the morning, there was the gathering of the students, and outside in the courtroom, and a ritual performance before Buddha, and then singing the Thai national anthem. Everything was very, very beautiful there. And we were honored as teachers. The Buddhist people honor teachers. They bowed before us. They made us feel really strange because, the children would walk on their knees before us, and the teachers would never get their head above ours. And we got to the point where when we would see them coming towards us in order to them not to do this, we would stand up so that we would be taller than they were. But this is a little story that I want to tell about a very good Buddhist friend. She and her husband grew roses in their backyard. They didn't live very far from where we lived. And she was a teacher at the school where our office was. And on this one day, she came by to see me. And she looked a bit sad. And I said, something is wrong, Ampuan. And she was a woman who spoke English better than most. And she said, oh, it has been bad. Sunsi, this was her favorite little dog, he is bite, and we must take to veterinarian and get him better. And I said, where was he bitten? And she said, in the garden. And I said, no, where was the dog bitten? Oh, in the leg. And she said, it's better now. It's getting better now. And I said, what bit him? And she said, poison snake. And I said, Ampuan, a poison snake. We were in a village where there were a lot of people around all the time. And I said, a poison snake in your garden? And she said, yes, but Mrs. Joy, no worry, is gone now. We call Buddhists, we call the monks, they come and they give blessing to garden. After they leave, I go out, I find the snake. She said, I go up to the snake, he coil and point his head at me. And I get down close to where he is, and I say to him, you must go away. You have done a bad thing. We do not want you here. Go away. And I just sitting there with my eyes like this. And I shouldn't have been surprised, because after a time you aren't surprised by the faith of Buddhist people. But she said, he uncurl and crawl away, and I follow him, and he go to Klong and swim away. The Klong is a canal that wasn't far from where we lived. And she said, I think maybe he was spirit of man who once owned all this property here. He was evil, greedy man. He was bad man. I think was his spirit in that snake. And then at another time, after she left, I said to my husband, can you believe the faith that somebody would talk to a poison snake and think it would go away? Because I grew up in Arkansas in the hills, and we had so many poison snakes, and all you did was kill them. And I said, told this to her. I said, I came copperheads, water moccasin, rattlesnakes, and even as a child we chopped their heads off with a hoe. And she said, is Christian way? And I said, no, it's survival way. Because I said, in Arkansas the snakes don't know that you can talk to them. And she also And she also said to me that when she talked to the snake, she spoke to it in Thai. She said, I speak in Thai language. He understand better Thai language. But we had talked before about reincarnation and so on. And one day she said to me, well, they always said, they were so good. So good, there wasn't anything they wouldn't do for us. And the people in the village would bow to us when we came by, because they knew we were teaching their children, and they knew we were doing it for nothing, and they knew that we were aged. and they revere age, they revere teachers, and they revere people who do altruistic things. And so they revered us for those three reasons. And so then I just want to say that we often talked about the difference between reincarnation and resurrection, but she would say to me, and they all said, every day I try to live better than yesterday, so when I come back next life, I come back in better place.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming. Thank you so very much. I know it's late on a Saturday afternoon, and we are so honored by your presence and just for your being here present with us. Thank you so much. Thank you.